She is with Union University, and her presentation, Christian Faith, Biological Reductionism, and Consciousness.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thanks for coming. I'm in the early stages of working on a book on consciousness. I gave a talk several months ago at a different conference on the more scientific aspects. This one's a little more philosophical. And I'm a biologist, not a philosopher, so I'm reporting mostly on things that other people's ideas. Some philosophers and actually some scientists are weighing in on these philosophical issues. Most biology textbooks have a diagram something like this. Biology is hierarchical. If you have a complex organism up here, it's made up of organs, which are made up of cells, which are made up of molecules, which are made up of atoms. There's a tendency to think of this hierarchy as reductive. That is, we tend to think of explanations at the lower levels as more fundamental. We explain the behavior of organs by reference to the behavior of cells. And if you can explain the chemical reactions that happen inside a cell, you describe the cell itself. And the physicists have been holding this over the rest of us for some time. Lord Kelvin famously claimed that in science, there's only physics, all the rest is stamp collecting. And nuclear physicist Ernest Rutherford, one of the fathers of modern nuclear physics, shortened this to all science is either physics or stamp collecting. Ironically, Rutherford's home country, New Zealand, honored him by putting his likeness on a series of stamps. Scientists speak of pure sciences or hard sciences as those that are more reductive, lower on the hierarchical ladder. So here's a cartoon, fields arranged by purity. Sociology is just applied psychology. Psychology is just applied biology, says the biologist. Biology is just applied chemistry, says the chemist, which is just applied physics. It's nice to be on top when there's the physicist, but of course there's the mathematician all the way over there on the other side. So if you want to be truly reductive, everything comes down to math. As a cellular and molecular biologist, I find myself somewhat torn. Some reductionism seems plausible. We really can explain the function of complex organs by reference to their molecular parts. A liver or a kidney really does seem to be the sum of its cellular parts, but there are a few corners of biology where reductionism seems to fail. 18th century physiologist Pierre Cabanis famously claimed that the brain secretes thoughts in the way that the liver secretes bile. But consciousness seems to be a different kind of thing than bile, or any other secretion of any other organ. And if you study the nervous system, consciousness seems, if anything, more mysterious. Neurons send signals along their axons. That part is easily understood in a reductive scientific kind of way. In order to be consciously aware of a touch to your finger, there's a series of three or four neurons, depending on what type of touch, that send the signal from your finger up to your sensory cortex of your brain. But how does stimulation of the sensory cortex relate to the conscious sensation of a touch to your finger? Nobody knows for sure, but there are many different approaches to understanding consciousness, and I'm going to highlight a few positions that are common among scholars who study consciousness. There are some philosophers, for example, Patricia Churchland, who take a highly reductive view of nature. Churchland is a materialist. She'd say that only matter exists. And specifically, she's an eliminative materialist. That is, she is reductive in her approach to nature, eliminating anything not material. So she's pretty much as hardline as you can get on the material scale. The reductive materialist position is sometimes called the nothing buttery position, because each level in the hierarchy of nature is nothing but the sum of its component parts. Churchland thinks that the idea of consciousness is folk psychology. We as a society have moved past folk physics and folk epidemiology, so in her view, eventually we'll move past folk psychology in the same way and get rid of this whole idea of consciousness. because Churchland's variety materialism rules out God and all values that have reality independent of the material world. Her view is pretty clearly not one a Christian would want to hold. Philosopher Daniel Dennett is also a materialist who's written extensively about consciousness. He wants to convince you that you are not conscious, at least not in the way you think you are. In a 2003 TED Talk with over 2 million views, he says, "I want to shake your confidence that you know your own innermost minds, that you are yourselves authoritative about your own consciousness." Dennett is coming at the question of consciousness from an explicitly reductive point of view. He says, "What we are, what each of us is, what you are, what I am, is approximately 100 trillion little cellular robots. That's all we're made of, no other ingredients at all. We're just made of cells." So that's the reductive position. Dennett argues that consciousness is an illusion by demonstrating various ways that your brain can create illusions. We fill in missing information in our visual field, there's the blind spot. A pointillist painting looks like a coherent picture from a distance, it's an optical illusion, but like blobs of paint up close. And he's right that your brain can fool you. There are real illusions, and here's one. The retina of the eye enhances contrast, making gray against white look darker than gray against black. In this figure, the center bar is actually not shaded. The appearance of shading is an illusion. You can prove it by covering the surrounding parts of the figure, and you can get one of these and print it out if you don't believe my computer animation. But going back, the gray bar on this side looks darker because you're comparing it to something light. Over here, the gray bar appears light because you're comparing it to something dark. And you really can't think your way out of that one. Dennett thinks that consciousness is illusory or deceptive, like this is illusory or deceptive, and therefore that we ought to only trust objective scientific knowledge. Dennett, unlike Churchland, is willing to allow for some sense of values or meaning that has reality outside of human biology, the physics of it. There are some theists who praise Dennett for caring about keeping commonly held values, and others who praise Churchland for being more logically consistent. But Dennett's view is also incompatible with Christianity because he says explicitly that his starting point is objective atheistic materialism. It's actually not really something that he argues for, but something that he assumes is a starting point, and he's clear about that. Dennett's writing makes a lot more sense when you realize that he's preaching to the converted. His goal as a philosopher is to construct a philosophical system that's consistent with his materialist intuitions. Now, there are actually some Christians who also have materialist intuitions. This is Kevin Corcoran. He's a Christian philosopher at Calvin. He writes, "I do not reject dualism, that is the position that humans are composed of both body and soul, on account of any kind of philosophical or other kind of argument. In fact, I find many arguments against dualism, philosophical or otherwise, to be pretty weak specimens. I'm what a friend calls an antecedent materialist. In other words, I come to the discussion assuming I'm a physical object, since that is what I've always seemed to myself to be for as long as I can remember." Corcoran calls himself a Christian materialist, which is a little confusing since many materialists define materialism as the position that there's nothing but matter. And of course, God is not material, but Corcoran is a materialist about humans. He thinks humans are just material, but not about God. His position is a form of what's called non-reductive physicalism that he calls the constitution view. That is, humans are constituted by their bodies in the same way that a statue might be constituted by metal. The statue is not identical to metal, because you could have the metal without the statue if you melted it down. In the same way, humans are not identical to their bodies. You could have a dead body that wasn't actually a human, in his view. So of course, Corcoran is a Christian and recognizes that his position creates some theological challenges for him to think through. For example, if humans don't have souls, how do we persist in the intermediate state between death and resurrection? Corcoran's answer is that people who have died actually do have bodies, but not glorified bodies that provide continuity of the individual and that they'll get glorified bodies at the actual resurrection. There are other ways that non-reductive physicalists who are Christians deal with that question, but it's something that if you're going to take that position, you need to deal with that as a Christian. Given Corcoran's analogy of the statue, he seems to be saying that we're not nothing but matter because we also have this order or organization or form to our matter in the way that a statue has that order. This position is therefore genuinely non-reductive, but it's hard to see from a biological point of view how organized matter gives rise to consciousness. We can understand what's going on in the brain, but it's hard to see why would that give rise to an experience like seeing color. As we'll see in a few minutes, neuroscientists are actually starting to move away from non-reductive physicalism for this reason. There's some interesting research on brain states that correlate with religious experience. On the top is the brain of a nun at rest and during prayer. And there's an increase in activity here in the left prefrontal cortex compared with baseline, right there, that red spot. And this is the brain of an atheist at baseline and while contemplating God. I'm not sure what that means for an atheist. But you can see there's little arrows there showing there's no difference. So there actually is a hypothesis. You do have to be careful when interpreting these studies. But there's at least a hypothesis that some people just have more of a natural ability to sense transcendent reality. And this, of course, is something you can also practice, so that's probably part of what's going on with the nun. There's also evidence that atheism has a genetic component, and it's possible that part of the atheist intuition is due to differences in the way different people's brains work. Of course, just because someone has strong materialist intuitions does not mean that they have to be an atheist. Corcoran's a Christian materialist, and others with materialist intuitions might decide that arguments against materialism outweigh their own intuition. But I do think that it is important to realize that some people do have the intuitions that Corcoran does, and that there ought to be options for Christians who have those intuitions. David Chalmers is a philosopher who describes the attempt to explain inner experience as the hard problem of consciousness. And he's very well known for this. It's relatively easy to explain how a certain wavelength of light activates your retinal cells, and how the signal is transmitted to the brain, your visual cortex. But explaining that is not the same as explaining how the experience of seeing the color arises. There's an explanatory gap between brain function and conscious experience. Explaining how something like a brain can create something like the color red is the hard problem of consciousness. Chalmers' solution to the hard problem of consciousness is to take experience as a fundamental property of reality. And that really surprised me for somebody who's as popular as he is. It's a fundamental property of reality, consciousness is, just as we take the attraction of negative and positive charges to be a fundamental property of reality, of matter. We can explain observations like static electricity in terms of the attraction of negative and positive charges. So, for example, if a cat jumps into a box of styrofoam peanuts, its fur loses electrons and becomes positively charged. The peanuts gain electrons and become negatively charged, and the peanuts stick to the cat. So we can explain this by reference to charge. Charge is a fundamental property of matter, which means we don't explain it in terms of anything else. And Chalmers wants to do this with consciousness. He argues that we ought to think of inner experience as a fundamental property of matter, not something that can be further explained or reduced to neural activity. Chalmers' position is actually a form of panpsychism, the view that everything is a little bit conscious. Simple things have only a tiny, tiny bit of consciousness, but they do have a little bit. Chalmers considers panpsychism to be an intermediate between materialism and dualism. Panpsychism is actually becoming popular among academics who study consciousness. Empirically, though, only things that have brains of a certain level of complexity appear to be conscious. That is, you don't see your iPhone, which a number of people will say actually is a little bit conscious. It doesn't act like it's conscious. Panpsychism doesn't really explain why beings with complex brains appear to be more conscious than other complex matter. Chalmers is a philosopher, but there are also a number of prominent neuroscientists who take the position that matter is inherently conscious. On this slide is Giulio Tononi, an Italian neuroscientist, and on the next is Christoph Koch. Tononi thinks that consciousness is integrated information, which could happen in your brain, but it also could happen in a computer. And he uses the Greek letter phi to represent the amount of integrated information and therefore consciousness that a system has, and he tries to calculate this. Technically, he doesn't think that all matter is conscious, so he's not completely a panpsychist, since it's possible for a system to have a phi of zero, but he does think that some computer systems are conscious. Christoph Koch started work as a young scientist in collaboration with Francis Crick, who of course is famous for being a Nobel laureate. Crick, late in life, decided that he wanted to try to solve the problem of consciousness. Their goal, and one that Koch has continued after Crick's death, is to find neural correlates of consciousness. That is, the project is to try to figure out what brain states correlate with consciousness. It's very clear that some parts of the brain are necessary for consciousness, but that doesn't mean they are sufficient, and as good scientists, they're careful to make that distinction. Koch calls himself a romantic reductionist, although his actual position is not really very reductionistic. It's similar to Tononi's that we saw on the previous slide, a form of panpsychism. So he will tell reporters that their iPhones are conscious. I think that panpsychism is actually a possible position for Christians, although like materialism, it requires an alternate explanation for continuity of persons between death and resurrection. Since in panpsychism, mind is dependent on body and the body disintegrates after death. I can imagine a Christian panpsychist seeing God's omnipresence manifested as everything being at least a little bit conscious. Christian panpsychists might also draw out the biblical ideas of all nature declaring the glory of God, or of all things being created in Christ. But to my knowledge, there are no theologians currently trying to work out the theological implications of modern panpsychism, so I want to be cautious there. We've seen materialist and panpsychist positions, and now we're moving on to dualism. This is Thomas Nagel. He doesn't actually use the language of dualism a lot, but a lot of people describe his position as dualist, I think fairly. He's famous for a paper called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And there's the bat. So of course, humans have sensory modalities like hearing and touch. Bats have echolocation that we don't have. And so Nagel's contention is that if you knew everything there was to know about a bat's nervous system, there would still be something that you didn't know what it is like to be a bat and experience echolocation. In contrast to Nagel, Daniel Dennett explicitly rejects the very idea of subjective knowledge, the knowledge what it is to be something. He thinks if you had all of that objective scientific knowledge about the bat's nervous system, you would have all the knowledge there is. David Bentley Hart has written about consciousness as part of a book in which he responds to the New Atheist arguments against the existence of God. New Atheists compare God to the flying spaghetti monster with the idea that it's just, there are any number of random gods that you could believe in, as if God were one being among many. The traditional view of God, though, Hart points out, is that God is the ground of all being and reality. So there can only be one God with a big G, including the reality of rationality and consciousness. So that's a big part of this book. In some ways, Hart is the reverse of Dennett. Hart argues that because consciousness exists, it seems likely that God exists as the ground of consciousness. Whereas Dennett argues that because nothing immaterial exists, including God's subjective consciousness, is illusory. Hart's view of consciousness is a form of dualism, not in the sense that there's a ghost in the machine of the body, but in the sense that God's divine logos shines forth in all things, giving being or existence to all things, and giving consciousness to beings that reflect the consciousness of God. For heart, the mind is a power that exceeds material causality without being free of the conditions of corporeal life. The mind and brain are both important for rationality. Neither is reducible to the other, and that's his form of dualism. So Hart is endorsing a pretty traditional theistic view of nature, which accounts well for consciousness. He sees the theistic view of nature as compatible with modern science, as long as you don't assume that modern science requires reductive materialism. And the last option on my list is different than all the others. Rather than proposing a solution to the problem of consciousness, Colin McGinn endorses a position that he calls Mysterianism. He has famously claimed that humans trying to understand consciousness are like squirrels trying to understand quantum mechanics. There is actually no reason that a Christian couldn't adopt this position. We're committed to the idea that God understands consciousness, but there's no reason to think that we must have the capacity to understand everything in nature. It's not a very intellectually satisfying position, but it's certainly possible that it's true. These are not the only possible positions, just the ones that are most popular right now. If we look at the big picture, the two extremes are materialism and idealism. That is, everything is matter or everything is mind. And there are a whole host of views in the middle. The two middle positions I've talked about today are panpsychism and a form of dualism. And the bonus position is Mysterianism. As I've described, I think any of these except for the reductive ones are possible positions for Christians. Or to turn it around, I think a lot of the motivation for the reductive position is avoidance of anything that sounds the least bit supernatural. I think the dualist positions are better able to account for the subjective experience of consciousness, that what it is like to see red or taste strawberries. Study of consciousness, both from a scientific and philosophical point of view, ought to be of interest to Christians, since the ability to account for consciousness is a major weakness of the new atheism. Conversely, because Christians believe that God is conscious, that God created nature, and that creation reflects the creator, any Christian view of nature will better account for consciousness than will any atheistic account. Thank you. Good. Well, I really like Hart. I don't know that I completely understand his position as much as I'd like to, so I'm still reading about this. I also like Thomas Aquinas. He's not a modern thinker, but he does do a good job, I think, of combining the importance of both the physical and the spiritual aspects of a human. And so he would say that you really do need your sense organs in order to sense anything, unlike, say, Plato, who would say that the body's just sort of not entirely necessary for sensation. But Thomas Aquinas, would not say that the body is all there is. You have to have these two things that work together. Yes?
Emergence fit into this in any way at the levels that you had of biology? There's new properties at each level, it seems like, that emerge out of the either the chemistry and then the interaction of the chemistry within the cell, now new properties emerge. Is consciousness an emergent property, maybe?
I think that Corcoran's position could be considered really similar to emergent emergent properties. He does not use that term. There's a position called property dualism, where consciousness or mind is a property of matter, which also is very similar to panpsychism. And so there's an awful lot of overlap between these different positions. But yeah, there are people who use that terminology.
Yeah, I think Nancy Murphy actually uses the
emergent. That's yeah. Right, yeah. And there's somebody over here in the back.
This sort of feels to me like we're struggling to find the necessary relationship between our physical selves and our non-material selves, as if there is one to find. And I mean, the Christian worldview entails a God who just puts things together the way he wants to. And perhaps he's sustaining the body and the mind in some relationship that clearly isn't necessary, seeing as we could be cremated and still be ourselves in some sense, like you're talking about. Well, what about the state between death and the resurrection? The real us is still somewhere, you know. So.
Yeah, but the idea is we want to have a theory that accounts for that. And there are different theories from different people to account for that in different ways.
I mean, is it possible that you can't really deal with this without invoking some formal theological point of view that isn't going to be understandable by any number of thinkers on this, on your
paper? Well, Thomas Nagel is not a theist.
Right, sure.
And so he deals with at least the concept of a soul from a completely secular point of view. So I don't want to say that you have to be a theist.
So there are actually a few scientific theories about that that I think could almost be like panpsychism, but not from a philosophical point of view. So I don't know if you're familiar, the ones that come to mind are Sheldrake's morphogenic hypothesis and Laszlo's connectivity hypothesis.
That's vaguely familiar.
Biology, psychology.
Yeah.
I mean, they haven't been that popular, but they do posit a non-material realm. And there's also a whole lot based on quantum entanglement. So, from a non-philosophical point of view, I think they would be similar to panpsychism. Is anyone else familiar with those?
Karen Barrett has made a certain term to process, and her work would be considered panpsychism.
Sorry, who was that?
Karen Barrett.
Okay.
She is a elementary particle theorist that turned early on to philosophy. Like a medieval world halfway or something like that. And Charles Popper wrote an article on response on panpsychism. I get reference to it. A lot of process theology ends up being panpsychism.
There's somebody else in the back over here. Did you hear
that?
Okay.
There's a question over
here.
One more question.
As a gentleman named Donald McKay wrote a book called, it was called Brains, Machines, Persons. It's older, maybe the 80s. I don't know if you've seen his work, if that fit into it.
I haven't seen that one. I'm trying to focus as much as I can on what's happening now, just because it's such an overwhelming problem in terms of historically. There's a lot that's been written about it, but thank you for the reference.
He was the ASA contributor.
Okay.
In the interest of time, we'll go ahead and conclude, but please feel free to stick around and talk with our presenters. Thank you.